This is the Education Gadfly Show.
We want more government, and we don't want to pay for it. And our politicians are happy to go along.
Mike, right. If you keep talking, we're going to get in a fight.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. Please welcome my co-host for this week, the Stefan Diggs of Education Reform, David Griffith.
I don't know what that means, but thank you, I think.
Stefan Diggs, he was the player, the Minnesota Vikings football player, amazing over the weekend, catching the ball in ridiculous ways, including this final catch that won the game with time running out.
I'm a researcher.
David Speaking Griffith Greek, has no idea what I'm talking about. I love it. But also joining us, our special guest for this week, who does know something about football, in part because she hails from Alabama, the one and only Margaret Horn. Margaret, welcome.
Hello, and roll tide.
Roll tide. We're not talking about college football right now. We're not happy about that, but of course you had to get that in there. Margaret is the Chief Development and Partnerships Officer at Centerpoint Education Solutions and former Vice President at Park. That's not a coincidence because Centerpoint, it's sort of what used to be Park, or the Park team became Centerpoint or something like that. Hey, one more thing on the Alabama thing. You once said that you are from the most Alabama part of Alabama. Is that right?
I am from Talladega, Alabama, which is the most Alabama one can be.
Yes, I love it. And this is why we don't give you too much grief for being, you know, a Crimson Tide fan, even though they are the team that everyone else loves to hate.
That's right.
But that's what happens with excellence. You know, when you're the top dog, everyone else is chasing after you.
That's right. And I do love hockey, but yeah.
God, Lord, David. All right. Hey, David's a soccer fan. Yeah. He finally put up in his office some decorations, and it was a nice display.
Yeah, Timbers.
For his Portland Timbers soccer team. All right. Hey, lots to talk about. Let's get to it. It's time for Ed Reform Update. Okay, Margaret.
Yes.
We want to talk about something. Look, we've talked about this here in the show before, written about it in Gadfly, that it appears we are in a phase of education reform right now that is going to be a little light on the policymaking and heavier on practice.
Right.
In other words, D.C. continues to be completely dysfunctional, but we have sent most of the power and authority back to the states with ESSA. And the states, though, don't seem to be all that eager to do a lot of new policy making either. I mean, we've got the normal fights over, you know, more charter schools or not, or more funding or not, or testing. And so that all continues. But in terms of big new initiatives, it just doesn't seem to be the moment for that. But what there is appetite for is to do the real work in the classroom of trying to improve teaching and learning and continue to work on implementing those higher standards that most states adopted way back in 2010. And so here's the question, Margaret. I get it. If you're a principal or a superintendent, what you might do to work on implementing standards, but what do you do if you're, let's say, running for governor this year, or I don't know, you run a think tank, or you are a philanthropist,
right?
In other words, you are outside the system and you want to encourage and support these efforts at improving teaching and learning. You guys have a front row seat to this. What might folks do?
Well, I would say that folks need to ask questions about quality.
Okay.
And ask questions about quality classroom tools that are flooding states and districts now.
Okay.
And ask quality about alignment to college and career readiness and really dig deep into those questions so that we're not just taking a publisher's word that something is aligned and high quality.
Yeah.
We're saying, okay, how was this developed? How did you do the alignment? And I'm getting really wonky here.
Yeah.
Asking questions about are the tools and resources that we're seeing being used in classroom implementation, are they predictive of success on summative tests? Are they predictive of college and career readiness? So I'm looking at you, our researcher here, wondering what you're thinking about what I'm saying here. And the other thing is, I would say, we need to all shine a light on the schools and districts and charters that mm-hmm. are seeing results. We're 3 years into Park and Smarter implementation, right?
Okay.
And so we're seeing that there are some bright spots and there are some districts that are doing really well and there are some charters that are doing better than others.
No, I look. I want to believe that. I mean, I'm just frustrated that there's so few states where you can get value added or growth data still. Now, and the states will say, well, it's a new test. We want to have 3 years of data before we come out with this.
Right.
I guess I understand that. Our former colleague, Dara, who is now at the Maryland Department of Education, mm-hmm. I know they are going to come out finally with growth data mm-hmm. This summer. But it's because I'd love to know, where do we see places that are showing major gains on Park or Smarter Balance, especially right. since we know these are high quality assessments. Those are great, but we want to see them. We want to hold up those places as examples.
And what's happening in those classrooms? Yeah. Like, what are they doing differently? How are they using technology? Yeah. How are they using diagnostic tools and interim yeah. tools? How are they cracking this nut of mm-hmm. Real world problem solving that mm-hmm. we hear so much about? How are they doing that on a day-to-day basis?
All right, so let's back up a little bit here, though, Margaret. So what you went right to is mm-hmm. is curriculum, right, and other materials in the classroom, right?
Yeah.
Which is fine. I mean, I think that makes total sense. Mm-hmm. You know, I've heard now Mike Cohen, who runs Achieve, mm-hmm. say a couple of times, you know, what would have happened back in the day, let's say back in the 90s, when the mantra used to be the Lamar Alexander horse trade. We're going, and not just the federal state horse trade, but really the state to school horse trade of saying, we're going to hold schools accountable and we're going to give them autonomy in return. Mm-hmm. Now, we never actually gave schools much autonomy because we didn't do a good job clearing out lots of the rules and regulations or teacher union contracts. But let's say that was the model. He now says that what we should have said is, we're going to hold you accountable, but we're also going to provide support.
Right.
Okay. We're going to not assume that each of these 100,000 schools out there has to go figure this out on their own. You know, we're going to assume that while there's not one right answer when it comes to curriculum or other resources, there's also not 100,000 right answers. You know, that there is, you know, it is real, takes real investment in terms of money and time to build a good curriculum or build good other resources, good diagnostic assessments or whatever else. And so, you know, there's going to be a few that end up really being excellent, and some mm-hmm. are going to be better than others, and we should make sure that teachers have access to the really good stuff, right? I mean, this all makes, and so, which by the way, is not quite the message we heard from the secretary this week, whose speech seemed to be about, again, let's let 1,000 flowers bloom, let's, you know, blow everything up and, you know, ask, which again, there's, you know, there's some truth in that too. I mean, we need to always question our assumptions,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't mean that there's not better ways of, say, teaching reading and then worse ways of teaching reading.
Right. And I think that's one thing. I mean, going back to what you mentioned, that we're on the front lines of yep. this and what we're hearing from school leaders and district leaders and educators is they're flooded with information and yeah. they're flooded with tools and resources. So how does one curate quality?
Okay.
And how does one build capacity mm-hmm. at the district level and mm-hmm. at the school level for those school leaders to make those kinds of decisions?
Yep.
What does good look like?
And David, look, this is a big shift also from, you know, just a few years ago, the big focus was teacher evaluation, this notion in some ways that we were going to differentiate between the good teachers and the right. bad teachers, maybe get rid of the bad teachers, mm-hmm. maybe reward the good teachers, hopefully give feedback to help some teachers get better. But now the focus seems to be more on, hey, can we give tools to teachers that make all of them better? I mean, what's your take? I mean, from a research perspective, I mean, is this more promising, or is this just, you know, a pendulum swinging in ways that's not helpful?
Yeah, I'm not sure that the two are mutually exclusive, yeah. right? But I mean, certainly I think everyone would agree that this is an area that's ripe for, you know, important work, right? And it requires, I think, a certain amount of stability at the policy level to really make any progress.
Yeah.
If you're constantly switching tests and switching yeah. policy regimes, and you're not going to be able to get the kind of stability in leadership and policies that allows people to actually develop curriculum. I won't speak as a researcher. I'll speak as someone who taught briefly,
yes.
right? I mean, it blew me away the amount that I was expected to do, right? For myself when I became a teacher, and it would have taken me
in terms of developing your own curriculum.
Yeah, it was insane, right? Yeah. And it would have taken me 2, 3, 4, you know, years to get to the point of, you know, where really I felt like I had a good curriculum, and that was, you know, even with support, I think that's true. So
I said before about 100,000 answers. I mean, it's really like we have 3 million different curriculum in this country. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Right? That's nuts.
Yeah. I mean,
or we've just outsourced it to the textbook companies.
Exactly.
And they've done a lousy job in general as well.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I really struggle with is I feel like every teacher has to process curriculum for themselves. Right? I mean, it's going to be different in every teacher's hands. So I feel like quality curricula it's a necessary but not sufficient condition, obviously, right? And so I think no teacher would want a bad textbook, right? But then for me, what I struggle with is like, once you have the good textbooks or the good whatever they are, right? Like, what is the next step,
then
right?
What?
Like, right, then what?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and I'm just going to bring back assessments and performance tasks into the conversation, because I think that that's something that's really lacking now. I mean, we have this focus on personalized learning and meeting kids where they are and giving them challenging problems. But what does that look like? I mean, how are we supporting teachers in developing their own real world problems that they're implementing into the curriculum they have? And just to point back to the teacher evaluation piece, I hail from Tennessee after Alabama. And, you know, Tennessee has a long history of teacher evaluation and lots of ups and downs on assessment. But one thing I think that the leadership there has embraced from Governor Bredesen, my former boss, to the current Governor Bill Haslam, is a commitment to building up teachers and building teacher capacity, because you cannot hire and fire your way out of the teacher corps. I mean, there are only so many teachers available. We hear about the teacher shortage, so we have to develop the capacity of the teachers we have.
And also fire the really bad ones.
That is
all
true.
All right, but okay. Yes. One last question, Margaret. So you hail from the reddest state in the nation, some would say, even though miraculously it just sent a Democratic senator to Washington.
My county of Talladega went blue.
It's amazing. That is amazing. All right, but set that aside for a moment. Yeah. So you're in a red state. You've got a gubernatorial election this fall, right? So how could in a red state, how could somebody running for governor say that they, you know, make an issue out of stronger curriculum, better materials for teachers? I mean, doesn't this run headlong into the whole local control thing, the whole, you know, statewide curriculum? I mean, it feels like a third rail. So the question is for the policymakers, for especially people running for governor, what can they say they are for when it comes to this stuff around, you know, teaching and learning in the classroom?
Oh boy, that's a tough question. And you're asking someone who was a former education advisor.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would say, I'm being a broken record here, I would go back to quality. And I would say, as a governor, I want to arm teachers and school leaders in Alabama with high quality resources. And then I would work with my education team. And of course, I would work with my good friends at A-Plus Alabama and the business community to have a conversation of what good looks like and what expectations for college and career readiness are in Alabama.
And you make sure it's voluntary. We're not saying mandatory.
Exactly. Right. And if you look at Alabama, you look at the manufacturing plants that are coming into the state. And so there is a strong business voice that could be part of this conversation. Mm-hmm. There's a strong higher education voice that could be part of the conversation. I hear you. Everybody's going to need to have flexibility. But I think there is a desire for exemplars and a desire for getting pointed in the right direction
right now. Right. Well, that is a great way to finish. Thank you so much, Margaret Horn. I hope you'll come back sometime.
I will. Now, to talk about Tar Heel basketball.
No. All right. Now it's time for everybody's favorite Amber's Research Minute. And Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
So were you watching the NFL games over the weekend in your house?
No.
What? I thought you were
Redskins are out, so like what's it all about anymore, you know? What I did hear, the Steelers had a pretty amazing loss, right?
They did, but and the Vikings on another game had an amazing last-minute win.
That's right. My husband was watching on YouTube and talking to me about it, so that's about my extent of the knowledge. Heard it with 18 seconds or something, and then...
There was all kinds of craziness. Fun. And again, Stephon Diggs, look him up.
Great slap shot.
No, you got David. Now you got to see, he made this catch, but the crazy part was that he made this catch and there was a guy right there who was ready to tackle him and somehow he just missed.
Oh, wow.
Like it was like the defender like closed his eyes and went to lunge at him and just hit the air. And you could see him like he catches the ball. He looks around like, why did I not just get crushed? And he just ran into the end zone. It's really worth seeing.
Worth seeing. Yes.
All right, I'll Google it.
All right. But I digress. What you got for us, Amber?
Well, we know there's been a big push for universal pre-K in many states. Appears to be growing. We have 1.5 million 3- and 4-year-olds served nationally, by the way, as of 2015-2016, at a cost of $7.4 billion. So anyway, I ran into the study by Erica Greenberg at Urban Institute. She's one of our EAPs, by the way.
Go, Erica.
She's got a new nationally representative survey of American adults on their preference for universal pre-K versus targeted pre-K. So, like, we don't actually have never asked Americans what they feel. We have all this debate in the blogosphere and the pundits about which one's right or wrong and the benefits. She uses data from a larger survey developed through the Laboratory for the Study of American Values at Stanford, fielded in 2013, which is, you know, there's probably been some changes since 2013 in views, but whatever, there it is. What's interesting and what I liked is she kind of does this EdNext thing where she tests the effect of the financial self-interest, like how we feel about our finances, and whether or not that changes support for pre-K by randomly assigning respondents to one of two scenarios, where they're asked to consider the personal cost of preschool, or whether they're asked to sort of consider that it'd be paid by somebody else. Okay. So first they're told like these programs are free for those who use them, and then they're given two scenarios. One scenario says, most experts agree that if the government is going to pay for preschool, taxes may have to be increased on households like yours. Or most experts agree that the government can pay for preschool without increasing taxes on households like yours. Then all are shown descriptions of both targeted and universal programs. And then they're asked, do you support or oppose government funding on programs like these? Instead of preferring, most people think, oh, they have to prefer one or the other. But what's cool about this design is they can show strong, weak, or equal support for one or both. Okay. Finally, the survey tests whether support is racialized, meaning do respondents associate targeted programs with a particular racial or ethnic group? The way they do this is they get a prompt describing a targeted program, so just testing for the targeted program in this case. Then they're shown a picture depicting the program where where respondents are randomly shown a picture of a white teacher with two white kids or the same teacher with two black kids, and they're asked if they would support or oppose the program based on that random picture.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is pretty intense.
It's pretty interesting. Key results. There are no distinguishable preferences for targeted or universal preschool on average. Roughly a third equally support or oppose both, and a plurality of 36% have no preference, though they are likely to favor than oppose both approaches. Yet many of them are nonetheless ambivalent, meaning they neither support or oppose. Across the sample, the possibility of higher taxes has no statistically distinguishable effects on support for targeted programs. That means that most Americans feel equally favorable toward public investments in low-income preschoolers, whether or not they have to foot the bill or pay more taxes. On the other hand, the threat of higher taxes substantially decreases support for universal pre-K by nearly a quarter of a standard deviation. A small number of subgroups, however, appear consistent in their level of support for targeted and universal pre-K, regardless of higher taxes. Those subgroups include Black and low-income respondents and parents of school-aged children, among others. Finally, there's no difference in support for targeted preschool by the race of the children attending overall or by subgroup. So those little, that last experiment, no difference. Yet the subgroup differences did service elsewhere. Specifically, self-identified Democrats and liberals favored targeted approaches, while Republicans and conservatives favor the universal approach.
That's interesting, which is sort of the opposite of what you find in this sort of policy elite world, I feel
Finally, we know, she says, just summarizes, both kinds of preschool enjoy similar support. And the author says the savvy policymaker should not necessarily endorse universal over targeted, given that the threat of higher taxes decreases support for the former. So
I feel like we need to stop using terms like liberal and conservative. They don't mean anything anymore. Like, I don't know what they mean.
Well, this is a good point. Amber, you have a strong background in the survey stuff. What's that? What's it called when people give the answer that they think the person asking them wants to hear?
Yeah, the halo effect, you kind of respond how you think people are going to, how you're going to look.
Yeah, I mean, in other words, like people don't want, like, if it's the truth that people don't want to pay higher taxes for this stuff, but they know that kind of looks bad, like, would they fess up to that?
Right. You know, that's right. Wonder. You want to kind of be seen positively.
Yeah. And anyways, what world is this where we raise taxes? We know we don't do this anymore. We just put it on the credit card bill, people, right? Right?
Well, there's that.
We just want more government and we don't want to pay for it. And our politicians are happy to go along.
Well, Mike, if you keep talking, we're going to get in a fight.
Now, in this case, you could say we should put it, you know, we always talk about, you know, we just pass these expenses down to our children and grandchildren. Children. But if we're actually spending the money on our children and grandchildren, then maybe at least you can justify that.
I mean, I don't know the answer to your question about what people truly believe versus what they're saying. Right. But I mean, I feel like you can find plenty of crazy survey results where people cop quite publicly to being crazy.
Yeah.
Right. And give crazy responses. Right.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I find this pretty heartening overall. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, I think America basically gets it. They get that it's sort of a, you know, there's reasonable arguments for either side. And and, you know, but they clearly understand that preschool works and probably works especially for low income kids, and that's the clear, you know, that's the clearest policy takeaway. I don't know. I don't know. I find that heartening.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and whether it works or not, which is of course something that we care a lot about.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I'm sure it just strikes people as unfair that, you know, if you're middle class and above, you're going to be you're doing some kind of school when you're 3 and 4. Mm-hmm, and if the fact there's still lots of poor kids out there who are not.
Yeah. And the socialization skills that come with that. I know sometimes we talk about, like, well, is it high quality pre-K?
Right.
Which is an important question. But some parents are just happy to have their kids playing with other kids, right? Interacting and learning the social stuff they're naturally going to pick up. So,
which is probably better than them sitting at home with grandmother watching TV. though, again, watching some PBS has been found to be helpful.
That's right. So in other words, we're
ambivalent about some of these things too.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think so.
Yeah. All right. Good stuff, Amber.
Okay.
All right, but hey, we want something. Can we have something a little more empirical next week?
Well, hello. This is not empirical. Erica is going to complain.
It's a survey.
But it's good stuff. Experimentational. Pre-K. We're spending a lot of money on this. Okay. So to find out what Americans think, I think it was a darn good survey.
All right. I'll let Amber have the last word on that. Well, that is all the time we have for this week. Until next week.
Oh, I'm David Griffin.
And I'm Mike Petrillia, Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.